What's up, fools? This is the QTR Podcast. Today is August 19th, 2018. And today's podcast is brought to you ad-free by my Patreons. If you don't know what Patreon is, it is a recurring donation service that allows you to donate as little or as much as you would like on a recurring daily basis. I love my Patreons. They are badass individuals. I'm still working on trying to figure out some content that's only going to go to my Patreons. But of late, I want to say special thanks to guys like Kevin Boyette, Mauricio Putz, Rob Lippich, Pete Yarborough, Ken R., Adam Pedraza, Kristen Rocca, Hugh Meyer, Guy Loopy, Austin Winthrow, my friend Christine Richard, then some people like Chris Boas who have come through, and Ken Raupack also have come through with some really generous Patreons, and I am super thankful to you guys. I think all of you guys I've shot individual emails to when you sign up. And that's not any boilerplate shit. That's I shoot you an email as soon as I get the email. And of course, Marco Vitti, who's been on back since, only July. He was complaining to me. I didn't hear my name on the air. All right, Marco. All right, here's your name on the air right now. Marco Vitti. How about that? Okay. Also want to thank some people like Jonathan Sumner, Michael Embley, Garrett Jarvis, guys that have been with me for a while. I appreciate it. All right. With that being said, I will also state up front that I am not an investment advisor. This is not financial advice. I know not of what I do. Do your research elsewhere. There is a 2-drink minimum. Okay, folks, we have rules here. We have rules for this podcast to prevent fucking chaos. We can't have chaos, folks. We can't have chaos. We need to have order. We need to have order. So today we're going to be talking about one of the things that I was deeply engrossed in about a year ago and then kind of put off to the side as I got involved with other projects, but it is one of the most fascinating things going on right now, and that is Fannie and Freddie. And I'm here with Adam Spittler. Adam is a CPA in Pennsylvania. He has a master's degree in finance from Drexel, representing Philadelphia. He's worked for KPMG and the last decade in corporate finance. And as he was quoted in the Bloomberg article after he did the Tesla podcast with Ross Gerber, where he was talked over for about an hour, he said his self-proclaimed expertise is in finding and identifying shitty companies with shitty balance sheets. But what many of you don't know, and I don't know if you follow him on Twitter, and I don't even think you're on Twitter anymore, Adam, but if you followed him on Twitter, you would know that he knows the Fannie and Freddie situation inside and out. He knows everything that's going on, and I don't know why that is, but he's involved in it somewhere, and maybe he can tell us. So first off, I got a million questions. Adam, what is up? How are you?
Pretty good, man. How's it going?
It's going as well as it can go for a Sunday morning. I'm still working on my first coffee, so I imagine things will pick up. you plan on making this content interesting, right, this morning?
I'm gonna do my best.
All right,
it's pretty dry, so we'll have some fun with it.
I imagine it is. All right, so first off, here's the first thing I want to know. I know you know a shitload about the Fannie and Freddie situation, and before we even get into it, I want to know why you're such an expert in it, because you seem to know everything. You seem to have all the bases covered. You seem to know it with granularity and with detail.
That is a great question. So
I know. I only ask great questions, so get ready. It's going to be a whole fucking hour of great questions, all right? If you were thinking that you were going to get mediocre questions, you need to put that aside. Otherwise, it's going to throw you off for the rest of the podcast.
So when I was in public accounting, I worked at mortgage clients. So I spent about 15 months at Freddie Mac in 2007 into 2008. So, you know, I had some exposure there. And, you know, during the time that I was down there, my dad's stockbroker actually pitched him on buying some Freddie Mac preferred, which, you know, this 2 weeks after he bought it, it was at 10 cents in the dollar, and he got completely, you know, screwed there. So, you know, that's kind of the background. And then in, I think it was about 2015, you know, the whole Twitter sphere of people are like, you know, the bailouts bullshit, this and that. I'm like, you know what, let's see if it was bullshit or not. So at that point, you know, I kind of spent some time going through the financials to decide or to figure out was the bailout necessary or not. And obviously, you know, wrote a paper on it, and you know, the findings were it was complete bullshit.
So you had some experience in the mortgage industry. You worked for Freddie Mac, and then you basically just went balls deep in it on your own afterwards.
Well, I worked at KPMG, and Freddie Mac was a client.
Ah, okay. All right. Got you. So yes. Let's talk real quick before we even get started about disclosing what you own. Can you tell us what you own just for compliance purposes so nobody gets upset and I don't get any emails that are like, oh, excuse me, the guy who's talking, he owns a share of Freddie Mac.
I own a bunch of Fannie and Freddie preferred. I do not own any common.
Boom. There it is, fuckers. And you're going to be expected to explain why you own the preferred and not the common at length over the next 6 hours. So I hope everybody is buckled in. All right, so let's talk about this whole fucking thing from the beginning. If I'm somebody that doesn't have any idea what happened, I mean, I know that Fannie and Freddie Mae both went, or Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae both went tits up before the financial crisis or during the crisis, and that's all I know. Take it from there and tell somebody who has no clue about this story why you own shares. What, you know, what government-sponsored entities are. Lay out the whole thing.
Okay. So Fannie Mae was created as part of the New Deal for FDR after the Great Depression. So prior to that, most mortgages were 10-year, 15-year mortgages, and the banks just held them on the balance sheets. So Fannie was created to basically purchase 30-year fixed rate mortgages, so the banks had liquidity to continue to lend, and that was one of the the items that got the U.S. out of the Great Depression.
So they were a stop. They were a stop for 30-year mortgages after banks had originated them to kind of store them somewhere, so that the banks didn't have to carry them for 30 years.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. The banks would get their fee. They would sell it to Fannie Mae. They get the money back, and then they were free to lend to somebody else.
Got you.
So Freddie Mac was created in 1968 because the government thought that Fannie was getting too big. And then I believe it was Truman, as a way to pay for the Korean War, decided he was going to IPO Freddie Mac into the public market, and the government was going to take all the money and pay for the war.
Typical government thinking. One entity gets too big, just create another one.
yes. Yeah. So, you know, Fannie Mae has always been, you know, kind of the headline, and Freddie Mac's kind of been the redheaded stepchild, if you will. So, you know, Fannie's been on the cutting edge of, you know, being a little bit more liberal in their lending practices, and Freddie's been significantly more conservative.
Okay.
So that's kind of that.
What, that's it? Do you think you're done?
Yeah, that's it.
Well, yeah.
No more follow-ups?
Hasn't some things happened here over the last 15 years? I mean, can you explain what happened between fucking Franklin Roosevelt and, like, you know, yesterday?
I was only interested in the history, but yeah. So in the mid 2000s, 2003, 2004, Fannie and Freddie, obviously public companies at this point, managing quarter to quarter, they started losing market share to the big banks.
Okay.
So, you know, they were a little late to the party with the private label mortgages, but, you know, in 2005, 2006. They started going in a pretty significant way, and that's what got them into trouble. So obviously 2007, 2008 happened. You know, the mortgage industry completely falls apart, and, you know, Hank Paulson decides that, hey, you know, we have massive balance sheets in Fannie and Freddie. We're going to use these guys to bail everybody else out. And that's basically what happened there.
So the reason that banks started to take the business again in the early 2000s was what? They just started to write 30-year mortgages again, and they basically,
well, so yeah, and anybody who's seen the Big Short in the intro, you know, big banks started selling mortgage-backed securities, and mortgage-backed securities were yielding, you know, 4 or 5%, and they were rated AAA. which is, you know, they could get a rate of return almost twice what treasuries were for the same amount of risk. So as that that financial instrument grew, they ran out of loans to make them. So, you know, the banks kept reaching lower and lower FICO scores, lower loan values, to basically satisfy the demand of people who wanted, you know, 4 or 5% paper that was rated AAA.
Got you. And then eventually what happened heading up to the financial crisis was what?
Well, you know, as the economy slowed down, people started losing jobs, you know, housing prices, you know, reverse course, people started defaulting on them. And then we found, you know, that the rating agencies rating them AAA was total bullshit. So, you know, you'd have, you know, 5% of the loans would default, and then all of a sudden the paper is worth 50 cents on the dollar and everybody got fucked.
Got you. So walk me through and walk the listeners through what a GSE is, and talk about the shift in the structure of the companies as they went through the financial crisis, and talk about 2008 on. I mean, what happened? How do we get to where we are today, and then where are we today for people that don't understand this situation?
So as part of the bailout in 2008, Fannie and Freddie borrowed $187 billion from the government. They have repaid that plus, I believe, $95, $96 billion on top of that to date. So that's why a lot of the folks are like, well, they paid everything back. They paid their 10%, you know, coupon, which is kind of what the Treasury set the bailout for. And they've gone back to, you know, underwriting safe mortgages. So, yeah, a government-sponsored entity is literally just a government charter. So that's all that means. And the charter says you guys can only buy mortgages with a FICO score of, you know, just hypothetically, you know, 700 and above. You need 80% loan-to-value. If you don't, you need, you know, mortgage insurance to cover the shortfall. And, you know, Fannie and Freddie, based on their charter, are only allowed to buy the creme de la creme of mortgages. So, you know, the interesting thing is if you look back on the crisis, you know, Fannie and Freddie's loan loss reserves were 3 to 4 times more than, you know, the Citi's and Goldman's and Wells Fargo's of the world. And it's total bullshit because they had all the best mortgages. You know, the banks had to buy the second tier shit, and they reserved, you know, 25% of what the government made Fannie and Freddie reserve.
So then why did they experience such distress?
Well, one would argue they didn't. So Hank Paulson used Fannie and Freddie to bail out all the big banks. So
what do you mean? How did he do that?
So in 2008, the spreads on mortgage bonds basically blew out. So you could have a bid at 20 and an ask at 60, and there's no liquidity in the market whatsoever.
Okay.
So what Paulson did was he took over Fannie Freddie, and they offered par for any paper that the banks wanted to sell. And they basically took all of the loss on the write down. So they created liquidity so the banks could get all the shit off their balance sheet that didn't have a bid in the market. And then they wrote the paper down themselves.
That's sick.
Yeah.
That's sick. So whatever shit paper the banks had on their balance sheet, they just took it at par, see no evil, hear no evil. Like, that's it. Just straight up fucking bailout.
That is all they did. You know, if you read through some of the legal filings, it's all in there. And they
I mean, wouldn't that in essence reward banks for going out and offering these shitty loans? I mean, if you were a bank that fucking pushed the envelope and, you know, say you were a small regional bank that went out and basically bet the house on the worst of the worst subprime, you know, no doc, no signature, no appearance, no pulse loans. And, you know, you did that because you wanted to generate a lot more cash. You know, isn't that type of bailout just rewarding people for, you know, bad behavior? Basically, it's rewarding people for committing fraud.
Yeah, it is. And look at the Treasury secretaries in history. Where do they come from? Paulson was at Goldman. Jack Lew was at Citi. I mean, they're helping their own.
Yeah, that's sick. I mean, when you hear a guy like Peter Schiff talk about the 2008 crisis, and you hear him talk about, you know, how the government basically offers positive reinforcement to banks in conjunction with the Federal Reserve for nefarious behavior and the moral hazard that it creates. I mean, this is a fucking perfect example, right?
Yeah.
So you're telling me it doesn't matter if they had shit rated, you know, B, C, F, or Z, they're paying par for it, no questions asked.
They got 100 cents on the dollar, no questions asked. Done deal. You know, the other thing that I didn't mention is after the savings and loan crisis in the 90s, up until then, banks had to keep capital in cash on their balance sheet.
Right.
After that point, the regulators allowed them to hold Fannie and Freddie preferred.
Oh, perfect.
Because they treated them, you know, like treasuries.
Right. Right.
And Washington Federal was one of the largest holders, and obviously they're one of the largest lawsuits. So yes. Yeah.
So that's just really created a self-fulfilling prophecy then, right?
Yeah.
If the banks are offloading all their shit to Fannie and Freddie, who's buying it at par, regardless of whether or not it's literally, you know, worth nothing, and the banks then are in turn holding preferreds of these two entities, quote unquote, as cash, you know, to have liquidity because they're so sound, they're helping themselves and then they're ruining themselves, right?
Yeah, yeah. And the funny thing is after a lot of the small banks failed in 2009, 2010, the FDIC actually auctioned all the preferred shares off to the private market. So that's actually where John Paulson got a lot of his holdings, because he bought them at the auction.
Huh.
So there's a lot of fuckery going on.
That's a great term. I would use that term. That sounds like sounds like exactly what's going on. Okay, yeah. So walk me through what happened to Fannie and Freddie. Now, if you were a public shareholder, if you owned Fannie and Freddie equity and you watched it go from $35 to 10 cents, what was that as a result of? How did the equity basically lose all of its value? And what happened kind of post-crisis? I mean, the government took control of both entities, full control of them, right? Talk about what drove the equity to zero and kind of what happened subsequently.
So you know, kind of up until September 2008, the whole market was in tailspin, so they were trading down, like, you know, Lehman and Bear and all the other companies. Once the government took them over, they decided they were going to throw GAAP accounting out the window, and they were going to basically kitchen sink every single quarter. So the first quarter, they went from, you know, like a $500 million loss to, they showed a $10 billion loss because they jacked up their loan loss reserves. They decided they were not going to account for hedges anymore. Which FAS 131, if you're interested, I believe it is. So as interest rates are going down, the face value of the paper that they hold on the books is increasing. So they hedge where if interest rates go up, you know, it offsets the price of their paper coming down. So they decided they were going to take all those hedge losses to the P&L right away.
Right. Well, that's not a bad idea, right? That's like a new CEO coming into a public company and just saying, I'm going to just fucking make this next quarter as horrible as possible in order to. So that's essentially what they did, right?
Yeah, but they did it for 3 years.
Okay.
so every quarter, they're throwing everything they can on the balance sheet to make them look like they're failing.
Right. Okay.
And all of the losses are non-cash mark-to-market accounting losses.
Right. Okay.
And if you unwind all of those losses and tie it to cash, they actually never had a negative quarter from cash flow perspective.
Really? So what was the delta? What was the difference between what they were telling the market and what their actual cash losses would have been?
About $200 billion.
In aggregate?
That's not, in aggregate,
not
yes.
Annually, right? Jesus.
Yeah. No, that would have been from Q3 2008.
Well, that sounds like a significant amount of fuckery. So for people that aren't accountants, myself included, what it means is basically, I think what you're saying is that, you know, that they're marking mark-to-market assets where basically you're holding the same asset, you're holding the same product, but the way that you assign a value to it when you go to report is very much discretionary and up to the person who's actually reporting it. so it can be fucked with. You can look at a television today and say this TV's, you know, state of the art, it's worth $9,000, and then the next day say, well, it's depreciated $1,000, and just tell somebody it's worth $8,000, when really the internal value of it, the absolute value of it, hasn't really changed and could be discovered on the free market at some point. But you're basically just saying what you think the price is. And what you're telling here to the listeners is that they were going in and purposely saying that the value of these assets was much lower than it actually was. And that when, you know, in kind of a post-mortem fashion, you've gone back and reconciled everything with, you know, I don't know, how do you make the determination of what it would have been worth in cash versus what they said? There's got to be some way to gauge that, right?
Yes and no. So the way that they valued their mortgage backed securities before the takeover was they did a discounted cash flow model of what they thought the future cash flows of all the loans were,
right?
Which is how you or I would value something. Afterwards, they knew that there was no bid on any of these, so they just marked them to market. They marked everything to fucking zero.
Right.
They said, hey, you know, the market's going to pay us zero, so we're going to take 100% of the loss right now.
Right. And even if things had gotten horrific and, you know, 50% of the mortgages in one of these securities defaulted, they still wouldn't be worth zero. You know, they'd be worth 10 cents, 20 cents, 30 cents on the dollar at least, right?
Right. And that's where, you know, understanding the charter for Fannie and Freddie is so important, because they can't buy any loans that don't have 20% loan to value.
Right.
So, or 20% equity, whether it's down payment or mortgage insurance. So they are buying the best of the best.
So the charter is a guideline from the government, if I'm guessing here, and I'm trying to just make this as simple as possible, because I know there's going to be people that aren't familiar with this, and I'm actually learning it too now. So the charter was actually a set of guidelines issued to Fannie and Freddie by the government that had parameters on them that dictated to them the only types of loans that they were allowed to purchase, right?
Correct. And you know, it also lays out what they can't do. So it's black and white that Fannie and Freddie cannot sell a loan to an end user. They can only buy loans from banks or financial institutions that originate the loan.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Okay, so tell me more about the charter. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, you know, it's the charter defines what Fannie and Freddie can and can't do. And the whole purpose is to make sure that, you know, a $6 trillion balance sheet doesn't vertically integrate the entire industry and fuck everybody else.
Right. So or evaporate overnight, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So pick up where you left off. Now, they've marked this shit on their balance sheet to zero when it actually has some residual value. They've kitchen sinked, you know, what, 3 years worth of quarters, and mm-hmm. then pick it up from there.
So there's also a clause in the buy-sell agreement with banks and Fannie Freddie that if any of the loans are misrepresented, they have the right of putback, which means they can force the bank to buy those loans back. When the government took them over, they said, we're not forcing anything to be bought back, whether it's fraud or not. It's on Fannie and Freddie at this point.
Right. So the government just comes in and says all bets are off in 2008.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, Bernanke, Paulson, all those guys were saying, hey, you know, when, you know, Fannie, Freddie are going to bear the brunt of this, when things turn around, you know, you're going to have your stock and everything's going to be peachy.
Yeah, I think Bernanke said in 2008, I don't know, I read it in one of my presentations, but he said something like subprime's contained and Fannie and Freddie will weather the storm, I think he said.
Yeah, there was a lot of bullshit those guys said back in 2008.
I'm sure they're still spewing a lot of bullshit wherever they are now, you know, doing speeches at places.
Yeah, getting paid good money for the bullshit.
Hanging out at the local Knights of Columbus. I'm sure they're just generally bullshitting people. So wait, answer to me kind of, what the fuck was my next question going to be? I had a question. All right, pick it up from where you were. So Bernanke and Paulson bail them out totally. And they claim that the stock is eventually going to come back up. What happens instead?
So, you know, the market starts to turn around. And then in 2012, I believe it was Q1 or Q2, either Fannie or Freddie, I don't remember off the top of my head, turned a profit. So they had positive GAAP net income. So, you know, all of the Treasury flunkies are like, well, we got a fucking problem here because we hate Fannie Freddie. We want to take all this work for the big banks, and it looks like these guys are going to be able to get out of it. You know, just not to backtrack, but one of the things that I should have mentioned is, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, Fannie Mae was the 800-pound gorilla in Washington, and Frank Raines used that and basically just destroyed people, you know, that he didn't like, and they wielded a significant amount of political power.
What does that mean? Who's Frank Raines, and what the fuck are you talking about?
So Frank Raines was the CEO of Fannie Mae in, I believe, in the 90s and 2000s. He left in the mid-2000s when they had an accounting restatement, which was total bullshit. It's a conversation for another day. But they did not make themselves any friends in Washington, which is part of the reason why, you know, Fannie and Freddie are so hated politically. So, you know, one of the guys.
Why did they have such a bad relationship with Washington?
Because they were the 800-pound gorilla, and they weren't afraid to wield the power.
What does that mean?
Here's an example. So Peter Wallison is one of the big outspoken. I hate Fannie. I hate Freddie. You know, the financial crisis was due to immigrants and poor people.
Okay.
Right. In 1997, he was on the board of directors of MGIC, which is a mortgage insurer.
Okay.
He got on Frank Raines' bad side. So Frank Raines went to the board and said, you're going to fire Peter Wallison off the board, or I'm not going to buy any loans that you're covering insurance-wise, and I'm going to bankrupt you. So they fired him. I don't want to say they owned a lot of the politicians, but, you know, they had their own little internal lobby.
Okay.
Where they would get what they wanted.
Got you. All right. So that makes a little bit more sense. All right. So carry on.
Where was I? I forgot what I was talking about.
I don't know.
I know before.
I know it's early. You know what I mean? No, you were basically just talking about, you said, I don't want to go backwards, but let me talk about the 70s and the 80s and the power that Fannie and Freddie wielded.
Yes. Okay. Good. So in Q1 of 2012, one of the GSEs turned a GAAP profit. And they actually, instead of taking money from the Treasury, they now paid money back to the Treasury. So, yeah, the Treasury and all of the folks involved are like, okay, we got a fucking problem here. Because we want to wipe these companies out, but now they're turning profit, and politically this could be an issue.
Right.
So what they decided to do was, instead of taking the 10% coupon, which was in the original bailout agreement, they were going to take all of the net income that Fannie and Freddie generated into the Treasury and fuck you guys.
That's wild.
Yes.
So while equity shareholders got absolutely demolished and saw their investment go to zero, the government then just decides 4 years later that they're not satisfied with the 10% coupon, but rather we'll just take everything that these companies make now in the future.
Yeah. And at the time, it's like, okay, well, you know, they just want to recoup the taxpayer, you know, bailout funds, et cetera. You know, fast forward to 2017, 2018, when some of the legal documents started being released in some of the lawsuits. They basically said, we can't let these companies out of conservatorship. We got to kill them, so we're going to take all their money. And it's in emails, black and white.
First off, it's just fucking wild that the government can even do this. I mean, let's just forget about the fact that shareholders are being screwed here. But the fact that this can even happen, that the government can decide in 2008 and say, all right, well, we're taking you under our wing. And all right, well, you guys are going to buy all this shit from the banks. This is how this is going to work. I mean, They just took it over. And then in 2012, they just come right out and say, we don't want the 10% coupon we talked about. We're just going to take everything. I mean, that's like fucking mafia shit, right? Like when you make a deal with the mob and then a guy stops by your house and he's like, yo, instead of fucking 10% this week, how about you just give me all of it? You know what I mean? Like some shit like that. we wouldn't want something bad to happen to you.
But the funny thing is, you know, you can't really blame Bush. You can't really blame Obama, because I don't think either one of those guys really knew what a GSE was.
Right.
So it's all of the Treasury guys that come from the big banks and the investment banks who are running wild with no oversight and basically doing whatever the fuck they want. You know, I think this whole story would be over already if not for the Wells Fargo account scandal that came up in a year and a half ago.
Well, what does that have to do with anything?
So Wells Fargo is one of the huge lobbies that, you know, they want to wipe out Fannie, Freddie, and they want to take over that guarantee business, because it's you make a shit pile of money, and if you fuck up, the government's
got your back, right? Yeah. Nothing like free market capitalism, right?
Yes. It could be worse. It could be Canada. So that's kind of the scenario there. So, you know, they decide they're going to take all the profits in 2012. And, you know, we've been at the same place ever since. You know, the only change about a year ago, you know, Mel Watt, before he was apparently sexually harassing all of his employees, decided that, you know, we're going to let these guys keep $3 billion of capital, and that's it.
So what's the argument being made by those who are invested in Fannie and Freddie now? Because there's a whole swarm of you guys that came in and bought the equity, bought the preferreds after all this shit went down, after the government has already kind of said, all right, they're ours and we're going to be able to take whatever comes up off the top in perpetuity for as long as we want. And now you got guys like Paulson, guys like Ackman, you know, you, I'm sure, other people that are listening that have all kind of swooped in, and you've taken various pecks at the equity and at the preferreds. What are you guys thinking? What's your investment thesis?
So you know, kind of before, you know, I did my work on the accounting side, the thesis was pretty simple. You know, there are, you know, 90 years of settled law around FDIC and conservatorships that the government's violating. So at some point, as the housing market recovers, Fannie Freddie are going to be profitable, and then the government's just going to let them go on their way. You know, it's a little Pollyanna-ish, but you know, that was the thesis early on.
Right.
You know, now a lot of it is based on, you know, government misgivings, you know, accounting fraud. All of that shit's in all the lawsuits now. The problem that we have is, you know, most lawyers and judges are financially retarded. Like, they don't understand this shit.
Right.
They're like, well, you know, my government does no wrong, so, you know, they got to be right.
Right.
You know, and one of the things that's really been eye-opening in all of this is, you know, the level of the government can do whatever the fuck they want, and they're going to, that exists in the world that, you know, I kind of had no idea. You know, you grow up, you generally believe that the government does what's in your best interest. Wrong answer. The government does whatever the fuck the government wants to do.
Well, and just to step back for a second, I mean, I think I always talk about this. Like, both my parents worked for the government. People think that, and they're both honorable people who you know, worked for their respective local governments for, you know, decades and did a damn good job doing it. But I think people in general kind of have this misconception about the government. They think it's this giant, you know, all-knowing, all-seeing entity, and really it's just a bunch of regular people. It's not, you know, the government isn't hiring the best and the brightest.
That's true.
You know, with the exception of my parents, of course, but they're just hiring regular people for the most part to do regular jobs, and it has too many of them. And there is waste and there is corruption all over the place. I just read an article in the New York Post a couple days ago about, you know, a whistleblower who went to the New York Post in the early 2000s alleging that people at the IRS were tipping off members of Congress about upcoming mergers and acquisitions so that they could trade on them. Now, it's completely...
That's a good point, because it's
completely unsubstantiated. But the point of the matter is, if people think that the government is this all-knowing, all-seeing entity that is structured with some type of perfection to allow it to operate with maximum efficiency, are crazy. And the only thing you need to do is go to a post office to understand that, or go to a DMV, because you wonder, how does the government, with all of this money and virtually unlimited resources. Why does the DMV have one employee on a Saturday working there? Why does the office look like it was built in the 60s or the 50s? You know, it looks like your old middle school. It's always awful. It always smells stale and bad, and there's old tile and pictures of like attorney generals on the wall from like the 70s.
So you've been to the one in Norristown, I take it.
Well, actually, I was thinking of my local one here out here by Lansdale. Yeah, but same type of experience. I mean, I went there to go get a license renewal maybe 6 months ago or something like that. And I pulled a number. The office, there were two people in the office. The office is about as small as a toll booth. There's about five seats in it. I pulled a number. I was 93, I think, and I looked up to see what number they were on. They were on like 36. I was like, so I went out, I got a haircut, I did my grocery shopping, I came back, they were on like 60. Yeah, exactly. And you're just wondering, like, man, this is the fucking best the government can do. Like, this is the best. Go ahead. I know you want to jump in.
Yeah, but if you think about it, you know, normal government workers are, you know, they're happy to do what they want to do. To your point, they're not the most motivated, not the best and the brightest. But on the financial side, they're pulling people from Wall Street. So on the financial side, they're pulling the best and the brightest, and they're just going to steamroll all the average people.
Right.
So what I wanted to say when you mentioned the IRS. So, you know, you remember the Lois Lerner thing where they were targeting, you know, Tea Party organizations or whatever the hell it was?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't follow that in depth, but I saw the headlines.
I'm going somewhere with this. So the head of the IRS is a guy named John Koskinen, was also the hatchet man that was put in charge of Freddie Mac after the conservatorship. So he was the CEO of Freddie Mac during the wipeout. And then he moved over to be in charge of the IRS and targeted people for Obama.
Oh, same guy.
Same guy. Yeah.
Okay, so what's the correlation there? I mean, aside from the fact that the guy's incompetent or an ass, what are you trying to make another point? Is there another tie there?
Well, the point was he's in all the IRS scandals, but before all that happened, he was made CEO of Freddie Mac after the conservatorship, so he was basically the hatchet man for Obama to wipe everything out.
Guy, so you're saying he's an inside operative or whatever the fuck Alex Jones would call him. Right.
Yes,
Alex Jones would say hatchet man, wouldn't he? I think he says it a lot. You're a hatchet man.
So the scary thing about all this is, you know, his one guy, Corsi or whatever, was talking about the whole Fannie Freddie thing on there. But
Jerome Corsi.
It's probably the one thing on Alex Jones that isn't a conspiracy.
Yep.
It actually happened.
I read that stuff when it happened. Actually, I think you sent it to me, and I think I wrote something about it on Twitter when it came out, to the tune of, you know, I think this guy's got it right, because the guy Corsi was obviously getting his information from people that knew it very, very well. I mean, this guy Corsi is not an expert in mortgage-backed securities or Fannie and Freddie or what happened in 2008, but what he was reporting seemed to be independently verifiable and very accurate. Which is stunning that he works for InfoWars.
I assume he was getting all his information from the people, you know, involved in the lawsuits, et cetera, who obviously know this stuff cold.
And it just goes to show you, like, you know, maybe 1% of the content that they put out or 5% of the content they put out actually has a little bit of gravitas to it. You know, I admit that InfoWars put out mostly trash. And there's a lot of sensationalism and a lot of bullshit, but regardless, I don't agree with silencing the guy, number one, and number two, you know, I would bet that people would be surprised if they could see objectively how close this guy has probably gotten to the truth on a couple of things. I bet it would surprise the fuck out of some people.
Yeah. And you know, if you can get over the emotional scars of seeing Alex Jones with their shirt on, you know, there's probably some truth to some of that shit.
Nobody needs to see that. See, that's the kind of stuff. Well, that's the kind of shit I'm talking about, you know, like him going up to people on the streets and fucking screaming at them. And I know it's part of his shtick and part of his bit. And I know he probably has to do some of it in order to maintain his sensationalist image and keep him in the mainstream media newsfeed. But that shit doesn't help him at all. And it's acting like a fucking total maniac that's got all these people who are I'm guessing left-leaning, probably some people on the right too, but probably more than not are left-leaning, that are so appalled and can't take the fact that this guy is on television, has a radio show, has a YouTube channel, whatever.
Right.
You know, instead of just sitting, you know, I was watching Bill Maher yesterday. I was watching a show from last week, and he was talking about Alex Jones. And he said, you know, I thought liberals were supposed to be in favor of freedom of speech. And I thought, you know, I thought he made a very good point. You know, freedom of speech applies to everything. It applies to the stuff you agree with vehemently and the things you disagree with vehemently. So, look, you can't call yourself a liberal and advocate for liberal philosophy and then want to shut this guy up because you just don't agree with what he's saying.
You don't agree with him, right.
You know, and then go out and make a huge stink so that these corporations shut the guy down. I mean, first off, what these people don't realize, this is only going to make him more powerful and more prominent, I think.
Yeah. I mean, look, there are a lot of people that aren't the most intelligent, so, you know.
I mean, if you don't think there's some website somewhere that's going to embrace having him on and tell him, look, we're going to host all your videos, all your content. We're going to guarantee you free speech. You can say whatever you want at all times. If you don't think somebody's scheming to do that in order to make some money right now, you're nuts. I mean,
absolutely.
He's going to find a platform, and the only difference is going to be that, you know, YouTube or Twitter or whoever, they're going to lose the views and they're going to lose the traffic, but... And it's a very slippery slope, don't you think?
Yeah, no, for sure. And, you know, the whole Silicon Valley media thing is its own discussion, right? You know, what do they censor? What don't they? Are they tech companies? Are they media companies? Who the fuck knows?
Yeah, I think it's...
Changes by the day.
I think it's Silicon Valley, not Silicon Valley. It's not a bunch of people walking around with breast implants. Actually, it is a bunch of people walking around with breast implants.
I was just going to say.
Maybe I'll just shut the fuck up then. But yeah, no, it's really a slippery slope, man, because you have these companies that are aggregating so much content, and somebody put out a funny tweet the other day that said, you know, the year is 2050 and there's only one Twitter user left. It's Jack after he's banned everyone else. Like, how are you going to decide who to ban and who not to ban without kind of infringing on playing favorites to one side of the aisle or the other, right?
It's all or none, right?
Well, isn't it just
no middle of ground?
Isn't it just so much easier to just say everybody gets a voice?
Well, you know, considering you can block people, you know, you can think for yourself, right? I don't need Jack Dorsey to fucking tell me who I want to listen to.
Well, yeah, you're right, and also, you know, look, if somebody's putting out something that's defamatory, that's a different story.
Sure,
but I don't think he was banned from being defamatory. I think he was banned just because he's postulating that, you know, all of this whack shit and all these conspiracy theories. I mean, look, coming out and saying that Sandy Hook was a false flag operation is an incredibly poor taste. It is it's a horrible thing to do, right? I mean, I think everybody agrees with that. That being said, he's not breaking the law by saying that. He's just voicing his opinion. I don't know, and as a content creator, that's the kind of shit, and I know we're going off the rails here a little bit, but as a content creator, that's the kind of stuff that really makes me nervous. Because you spend so much time building up a following on YouTube or on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever, and you never know when it's going to be yanked out right from underneath you. So that's why I'm always... Go ahead.
And you have no recourse.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh, yeah, you just assume, you know, forget about it after you're banned. What are you going to do? I mean... Trying to apply for a reinstatement, and then they got to make you jump through all these hoops, and you got to watch what you say. You're better off just... I would never do that. It'd just be fun, go out, find Vimeo or somebody that's going to allow you to post your stuff, and just do it after that. Okay, yeah. So let's go back to the GSEs. So Corsi reports all this stuff, and this was coming at the same time that, actually, if I remember correctly, this was probably 3 years ago, 4 years ago, that the story was actually starting to get some traction in the mainstream media. I remember the one guy went on Tucker Carlson. I forget his name. Rosner? Is that his name?
Yeah, Rosner.
Yeah, Rosner went on Tucker Carlson and laid out the case pretty well on national television. And Maria Bartiromo at one point was reporting on it. Walk me through, like, the last 3 years. What's happened?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Kudlow did as well. Yeah,
okay.
Before he was in Yeah, and with Trump. So the last 3 years, you really have two different legal paths. You have the Court of Claims, and then you have, you know, the legal courts. So Court of Claims is where all the documents are coming out and being unsealed. And then you have, you know, the legal courts where, you know, the shareholders have lost every single case to date. And that, you know, the Court of Claims is basically the government took something that was mine and I'm due just compensation. The other courts are, you know, there's 90 years of settled law under FDIC for conservatorship and receivership. And the way the conservatorship for Fannie and Freddie is written, the legislation, is unconstitutional. It's illegal. So those cases have been a failure so far. Now, there have been two justices in two different appellate courts that have agreed with the plaintiffs, but, you know, one out of three doesn't get you a win.
Right. What's the difference between the Court of Claims and the other court where this is being adjudicated? I don't know what the difference is.
I'm not a legal expert, so yeah, I'm not sure other than the actual claims.
Doesn't Court of Claims specifically isn't Court of Claims specifically for people that have claims against the government only? Or am I incorrect?
It might be.
Okay.
It might be, but I know those cases are, you know, the government took my property. I'm owed just compensation, so okay. Fuck you. The other cases are the government didn't have the legal grounds to do what it did, so they need to unwind everything. And that's where, you know, the judges have all ruled that, you know, the government can do whatever the fuck the government wants and, you know, go pound sand.
Right. So how are both of these cases progressing? Where are we procedurally with them? I mean, what's your investment thesis, man? Let's talk about what you think is going to happen, what's a likely scenario, and then tell me what's an unlikely scenario. I mean, you looking to get a legal victory here, or are you looking for somebody to just fucking come to their senses in the government?
Well, so there's two different points here, right? So the government, in their bailout, they have a claim to 80% of the common stock in warrants.
Right.
So if they were to release Fannie Freddie from conservatorship, you know, they would reap a windfall between $80 and $150 billion.
Right.
And the $150 billion is, I believe, Ackman's number from his Q2 investor presentation. So, you know, the government can't realize that return while the lawsuits are going on.
Right.
So, you know, does Trump give a fuck about $100 billion? Maybe, maybe not. Who the hell knows? So in the meantime, you know, you're trying to have at least, you know, one court say, hey, the government did something fucked up here. You know, let's take a look at it.
Right.
So, you know, like I said, there is one judge in the DC Court of Appeals and one in the Texas Court of Appeals that wrote a pretty scathing dissent against the government and basically said, you know, this is fucked up. But, you know, the other two judges are like, we don't care. It's the government. So there's, yeah, there's one other case, I believe it's in Minnesota, and the three judges there are all, I don't want to say they're friendlies, but they're not, you know, oh fuck knows.
Right.
So you know, we'll see what they rule in the next, you know, 60 to 90 days, and you know, and at some point, hopefully, people can, you know, look behind the curtain and see that, you know, there's a lot of fuckery going on here.
So the people that are suing the government, they're looking for, I mean, are they looking for a straight up victory? Are they looking to win their cases? Or are they just looking to get enough shit out in discovery to kind of, you know, force the government into a position where they want to settle? What do you think their end game is here legally?
So the Court of Claims case has been extremely productive in getting some of those documents out. And, you know, again, I don't know the people that are suing. I don't have conversations with them, but, you know, kind of my assumption is, you know, the Court of Claims is through discovery. They're trying to get as much of that documentation unsealed to use in the other cases as they possibly can.
Got ya.
You know, the other cases, I don't want to say they're home runs or Hail Marys, but, you know, you're hoping, you know, two of three judges are skeptical enough to say, hey, you know, something fucked up, you know, went on here, and the government, you know, negotiated with itself, and you know, they took all the future earnings of the companies and fucked the shareholders, which is exactly what they did.
So what does the road to recourse look like if you're holding the common equity, or if you're holding? So I'll let me just preface this again by saying, you know, this isn't investment advice at all. I mean, I'm talking to you about your position. What does the road to recourse look like in your analysis if you hold the common equity? What are the odds that you're going to be able to see some value return to the common? If you hold the preferreds, what do you think the odds are of the preferreds kind of, again, becoming worth something? They're not no bid, but, you know, I think they're trading at, most of them are trading
at $6.
Heavy discounts, right?
Yeah.
So talk about the difference between the two share classes, and then walk us through what it looks like for the equity to have value again, in your opinion.
So it's funny. My buddy and I joke all the time. We're going to call Kramer and be like, just in the MI diversified segment, give him five different GSC prefers and be like, MI diversified? And he'd probably hang up on us. But, you know, I'm in preferred, and the only reason why I'm in preferred over common is the par is 25. It's trading at $6, and the basis of most of mine is three-ish, and you're higher in the capital structure.
Right.
So if it does go into liquidation, you know, there's a chance you get 50 cents on the dollar back.
Right.
Now, from a logistical standpoint,
that would essentially be a double anyways, as opposed to a 4X, right?
Yeah, and, you know, from a logistical standpoint, how the fuck do you liquidate $6 trillion of balance sheet?
Right.
Ain't ever going to happen.
Right.
You know, the common would have, you know, more value if, you know, the government decided to right every wrong it's ever done. You know, say, hey, we don't want the warrants. We fucked up. Now, here you go, people. We know you're crazy on Twitter, but here's $150 a share for something you paid, you know, $2 for.
Right.
Which ain't going to fucking happen.
Not going to happen, right.
No. You know, I think the reason why Ackman's in common versus preferred.
That was going to be my next question.
Is nothing more than he was a little late to the party, and there's only a fixed amount of preferred outstanding, and he couldn't accumulate preferred to the size enough that moved the needle for his fund. So he decided to go common.
Interesting. So, I mean, what do you think his – I mean, look, he's not going to go out and buy a whole whack of common without having some case for value coming back to the common. I mean, you think it's a situation where he argues strongly for a full kind of concession like you're talking about, and then takes the concession of the preferreds instead as a win? I mean, because he does own preferreds, and he's been buying the preferreds, right?
Yeah, he has been adding preferreds, and look, you know, the three big funds that own preferred early on, I mean, they're all kind of defunct at this point. So,
right.
You know, it's not hard to buy a sizable chunk from anybody at this point. You know, I think his thesis is pretty simple, right? So the government is inherently greedy.
Right.
The government owns 80% of the common shares of Fannie Freddie.
Right.
The government is going to want to extract their pound of flesh and you know, make their $100 billion. And if that's the case, then the other 20% of the common get paid as well.
Right.
You know, the item that you and I really don't have to worry about, that all the big funds do, is obviously they're being managed quarter to quarter, but you have time value of money. So this shit's been going on, you know, a lot of these funds bought in 2012.
Right.
Well, you know, if you look at the market, that's up an average of what, 15% over the last, you know, 10 years. And these guys are in GSC preferred, you know, hanging up a goose egg or single digits. They're lagging the market. So, you know, whether they're right or wrong on the investment, their comps, they're behind. So you're going to have people pulling money out of their fund. And that's the battle that these guys are fighting.
So as a investor in the preferreds, I mean, what do you look at for a time horizon? Or are you just very patient? You know, you just don't mind at this time?
You know, I look at it from a standpoint of being patient. You know, the lip service that Trump and Mnuchin have given Fannie Freddie.
Because there was a fair amount, priority. Like right after Mnuchin was appointed, I mean, they came out and they addressed it several times. And there were, you know, all these headlines that came across the terminal saying Fannie and Freddie, you know, can't stay under government conservatorship. And then all of a sudden, everybody went to sleep for the past year and nobody's done anything about it.
Well, I think they overestimated how quickly they were going to be able to get some of the key legislation through. And obviously, the Obamacare thing ended up being a goose egg. You know, they got some of the tax cuts through. But, you know, he's 2 years into his office now. And, you know, I don't think they put as many points on the board as they thought they would. And, you know, I think they're waiting for midterms now. A lot of the opponents of Fannie Freddie are leaving office this year. So Corker's out. The dude from California, Royce, is out. You know, a lot of the guys that are.
What was Corker's beef with Fannie and Freddie? I mean, I remember seeing this guy on television like 3 years ago telling people on CNBC to go out and short it, or it would be a good short. And I'm like, why the fuck is this senator giving investment advice on CNBC, number one? And like, what is his problem? What's his beef?
So it's funny. So one of the disclosures that Corker had was he has a big investment in a hedge fund. It's called Pointer. But that hedge fund was one of the big shorts along with John Paulson in their Abacus fund, the security or the private label security that Paulson had. I believe it was Goldman made for him to fail. So Corker was short the housing market through that vehicle in 2008. But he's also gotten a lot of favors from Wells Fargo. He's a big real estate guy in Tennessee, I believe.
Okay.
And you know, Wells Fargo's bailed him out a couple times because I know he was underwater to the tune of like $25 million in 2008, and Wells Fargo came to the rescue. So I don't think it's necessarily that he hates Fannie Freddie, but he loves Wells Fargo.
Gotcha. Well, you could tell. Look, when you hear the guy talk about it, you can tell there's some deep, you know, he has some deep personal interest in it. And this is a guy who also, by the way, I don't know if you saw, but back in like 2012, 2013, there were a couple of stories that came out about his trading records. And, you know, he has these exceptional trading returns, trading U.S., mostly U.S. listed ADRs or ADSs or whatever they're called, of foreign listed stocks. He was buying like the OTC ADRs of international stocks, the weirdest fucking names, you know, all those tickers that have like five symbols to them, you know, ADTNY and like all those like crazy ADR listings that trade 100 shares a day on the over the counters. This guy was out there making huge moves in them and making
You want to know why?
Why? Yeah.
So he's close with CBL, which is a REIT down there. CBL is in a building where they're right next door to, I think it's Deutsche Bank.
Okay.
Or UBS. One of those firms are right next to. And if you look at, I think Beth McLean did the article on it. But if you look at it, all of the upgrades are from the broker that's right next door to their office. It's the shadiest fucking thing ever.
Doesn't surprise
me. It's fucking hilarious. Yeah, no, and look, if you're a senator, what are they going to do? They ain't going to like you up.
Yeah, and I was looking at a chart of, like, equity trades by members of the banking committee, and it was like, you know, the first three guys were, like, 7, 12, 6, and then Bob Corker was, like, 156.
I think Toomey was number 2 at, like, 25, mm-hmm. and Corker was at, like, 300.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so forgive me if I don't think something isn't going on there. And that's always what kind of struck me odd about him going on television and seeming to have such a beef about Fannie and Freddie. But, you know, going on.
It's funny, you know, that the deeper you dig, you look at all the people that have come out and, you know, they either lie about Fannie Freddie causing the crisis or, you know, they want to give it to the big banks. They have an axe to grind.
Right.
It's either against Fannie Freddie because they've been wronged in the past or, you know, they're in the bank's pockets.
So are the both entities are still under full conservatorship now?
They are. You know, the most interesting thing is Mel Watts' office is up at the end of the year. So Trump is going to have to appoint a new head of the FHFA.
Okay. And if you don't know who Mel Watts is, explain who he is and what he does and why he's integral to the story.
So Mel Watt is the director of the FHFA, which is the government oversight board that runs Fannie Freddie.
Okay.
So Mel Watt was an Obama appointee. He's out this year, and you know, we'll see what Trump does. I know for a while, you know, there were rumors that Hensarling, representative, I don't even know, from Texas, and he hates Fannie Freddie also. But he's out of the running. He's going to retire, and you know, we'll see who he puts in there.
Interesting. And why does that have an impact? Why does it matter who the guy is running the show? I mean, can't the government just put enough pressure on whoever it is to, if they want to withdraw from conservatorship, couldn't the government just go to him and just say, hey, you know, look, we need you to do this, this, and this, otherwise we're going to have a fucking problem?
They can. And, you know, that's one of the integral items in the lawsuits. So in the legislation that created the FHFA, the FHFA has to be independent of Treasury and all of the government agencies. So the government can't have oversight.
Sure. Sure.
But they do anyway. Yeah, right?
Just, you know, like, I mean, the Fed is independent.
Yeah.
Same way. Yeah. So what is your most likely, you know, tell me about what your thesis is. I mean, what's the scenario that you think is most likely that's going to cause the preferreds that you own to go from $6 to $24?
You know, barring a home run in one of the court cases, you know, I think Mnuchin understands the housing market extremely well. You know, he comes from this space. You know, he's mentioned multiple times that his number one priority is to protect taxpayers, and the only way to do that is to have them retain capital. And if they retain capital, then you know, the preferred shares go up in value because you have the asset base, you know, for redemption.
So what that means is, to the layperson, is that Fannie and Freddie would start to, instead of distributing their net income, instead of distributing the money that they make, the cash that they generate, they would start to hold it internally and create essentially a pile of cash just to sit on as a foundation. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And, you know, as they develop capital requirements, and you know, the last number I saw was about $150 billion between the two of them of capital. Once they get to that number, and again, that can take a couple of years, you know, then they'll be obligated to pay dividends again on the preferred.
Gotcha. So the process would look like, first thing you do is stop distributing the profits to the government, and you start retaining them retaining partially, at least some of them. Then you build up enough of a war chest to ostensibly try to prevent a major catastrophe in the future again. So you essentially have the companies insure themselves. And then third from there, you can start to distribute a dividend to the preferred shareholders again.
Yeah. And again, you're probably looking, you know, 3 to 5 years before that happens. But, you know, again, the share price would obviously appreciate over that time period. And, you know, you're also banking on the government to say, hey, look, I got 80% of the common warrants. I want to monetize that.
Right. And what's the what is the other side of the case? What's the worst case scenario for somebody that holds the preferreds?
You know, Fannie Freddie aren't going away. I think that talk is dead at this point. You know, the nightmare scenario is this drags on for another 10 years and nothing happens. So it's dead money. Yeah, it's opportunity cost.
Got you. So did we once talk about a potential scenario where all the preferreds are ultimately all the preferreds could ultimately be kind of converted into common in order to kind of put everybody on a playing field that's level? Or was that somebody else I was talking to about that? Was that you?
It may have been me. I think there are a bunch of different scenarios, and that's really based on how quickly and how are you able to recapitalize. So if they go out to market and say, hey, we want to recapitalize tomorrow, they're going to be, you know, tens of billions of dollars and say, hey, you give us an 8% coupon, we'll give you as much as you want.
Right.
In that instance, they're going to want the junior preferred out of the way. And you know, may hypothetically, there is a convertibility scenario where the junior prefers get converted to common, and then you have the new senior preferreds come in to raise capital. But, you know, then
Because the newer investors are going to want the sweeter deal, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you get to that case, then you're talking, you know, $25 billion total shares of common. Where do you go with them all?
Right.
You know, so, yeah, I think that's the only scenario where, you know, there's some sort of convertibility.
And what's the most recent thing that's happened here of late in this story? So what's the last piece of news to kind of break on the on the front of this battle? Because I haven't really read anything about it recently.
No, about a month and a half ago, there was a Texas case that went to appeals court. And, you know, there were some hopes that, you know, if any district is going to say fuck you to D.C., it's going to be Texas, right?
Right. But,
yeah. So, you know, that came back 2-1 in favor of the government. And, you know, the one dissent was pretty scathing. But, you know, 2 out of 3 gets you a win, not 1 out of 3. So that's basically been it. You know, Trump and Mnuchin have said, yeah, after the midterms, they want to focus on Fannie and Freddie. But they've been saying that for 2 years. So we'll see.
And the scandal here again is, and the reason that people are so fucking up in arms about this whole thing, is the fact that it creates a dangerous precedent, right? If the government can just come in and take these companies over and decide to put them into conservatorship and then decide to just take their future profits, and then it's up to the government still as to whether or not they release them from conservatorship, it sets up kind of what could be an ugly precedent for companies in the future, right?
Oh, it does.
It's a slippery slope. What's to stop the government from coming in and taking over Apple, IBM, you know, my hot dog stand?
No, that's a good point. And, you know, just because Fannie Freddie are government sponsored, they're private companies. You know, they're not government entities. The government doesn't have any more right to take Fannie Freddie versus Apple, to your point. And it creates a huge negative precedent. You know, they can come in, they can take over Amazon if they wanted to. You know, it basically rewrites all the receivership/conservatorship laws for banking, and you have no idea what your rights are as a shareholder.
Yeah,
and it fucks everything up.
Well, and you know what? I wouldn't be surprised. Unfortunately, with the way that I have a lot of gripes with the financial system as a whole and the economic machine as a whole, at least from what I can understand. The more I learn every day, kind of the more appalled I get, but it really wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I feel like this country is just slowly heading down the path toward where Japan is right now, and that eventually we're going to get there, and eventually it's going to get worse than that. I mean, we bought into this system that government knows best, and the government's going to be afforded the ability to do whatever they want, whenever they want to do it, and there's no foreseeable way to stop that unless something drastic happens and the currency gives out or something where we're going to have to pay attention. But I mean, unfortunately, it doesn't even surprise me.
No. And there's a famous saying that says never let a good crisis go to waste. So, you know, the next crisis, they're going to be scooping up whatever the fuck they want. Yeah. Same thing that they did in 2008.
Well, let's go macro for a second while you're on the phone. I mean, what do you think about our monetary policy as a whole?
Well, anytime you have $21 trillion of debt, you know, it's what, 25% of GDP? That's kind of a fucking problem.
It's just, I was just watching a clip the other day of Peter Schiff arguing with some liberal on MSNBC. And yeah, he said to her, going into more debt is not how you pay off debt. And she said, that's not true. It's just like, that's what it's come to.
Oh, I mean, it's all relative, right? You know, outside of a handful of countries, everybody has, you know, a shit pile of deficit. The problem is we have the most because we have the largest economy. So at what point do the chickens come home to roost and you end up devaluing the currency and everybody gets fucked?
Well, and I think a lot of it has to do with confidence and people's confidence in the country. And if that somehow is shaken one way or another, whether, you know, it could be one of our allies just coming out and calling us out and just saying, hey, you guys got to get this under control. As that kind of tension creeps up, people think that it's not possible. 10 years into this bull market where basically everybody has been feeling as though they've achieved fucking investing nirvana over the last 10 years while the house burns in the background. everybody thinks that it's not possible. People forget so quickly and so easily. And then when a 2008 happens or a 2000 happens, you get all these indignant pundits on television. This is insane. You know, there's no way. I don't know how this could possibly happen. It's like, motherfucker, you haven't been paying attention. Like, this is the same people that, as this is occurring and as we've been experiencing this euphoria, have not even discussed, let alone entertained with 1% of the fiber of their being that something like this is possible. And then when you come out and you talk about it and you point to the $21 trillion debt pile and you say, look, this is a problem that eventually we're going to have to look at. You know, it's like, oh, this guy's a bear. This guy's a doomsday sayer. It's like, how about fucking reality? Like, what happened to fucking reality? Does that still exist?
No, it's funny because, you know, to your point, half the people in the financial workforce weren't working in 2008, you know, and anybody under the age of 31, 32, they have no memory of the financial crisis. You and I lived through it, but, you know, it's...
Yeah, that's sick. That's what I was talking to Peter Schiff about when he came on, was the fact that if you think about it, if we've been in a bull market for 10 years, I mean, people that were 18 or 19 when the financial crisis happened and have now gone through college and are working junior wealth manager jobs at AXA Equitable Advisors, it makes sense to them. They're like, yeah, just put it in ETFs, you know, like just buy the fucking SPY ETF, you know, like
they've been working my whole life.
Yeah, exactly.
10 years.
Exactly. Now, you know, I've got 6 years or 8 years of professional experience, and in that time, the Dow has gone from 12,000 to 24,000, and so I don't know why you wouldn't just invest in all ETFs. And I don't know, man. This is like one of my biggest gripes. This is one of the things I talked about at the Case Learning Conference, that and the Street did a write up called, you know, Short Seller Trashes Warren Buffett's Investing Methods. And I'm not trashing Warren Buffett's investing methods. I'm just saying the genius of Buffett and the genius of buy and hold investors only works if the system and the theory that it's based upon hold up.
Well, I mean, you also have to look at, you know, what is the genesis of most of Buffett's investments, and it's literally rape lending when the companies are up against the wall.
Oh, I mean, often.
USG is a perfect example.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, USG is a perfect example. You know, they build wallboard. Well, in 2008, they were teetering on the verge of bankruptcy. He bought 33% of the company for a fucking rounding error.
Right.
Sold it and made a fortune this year.
Yep. And did the same with Bank of America during the financial crisis, because he lends his name to it. He's got some gravitas. Yep. And when you have gravitas like that, all you got to do is use it to your advantage. Same way he bailed out fucking HomeCap too. I mean, he's getting these incredible deals, yet somehow when he's on television, he's this like cute, lovable guy from Omaha who likes to eat a Big Mac and drink a Coca-Cola every day. And he still drives around in the same 1980, you know, look, I don't have any gripes.
If you believe
the guy's obviously fucking genius. Okay. The point is that the guy's obviously a genius, okay? He has amassed an enormous amount of wealth, and he's very opportunistic with things like that. And I've heard stories from people who have had their family businesses approached by Buffett. And he is a tough and shrewd motherfucker. Like, he's not some friendly guy just buying 100 shares of Johnson & Johnson in his E-Trade account on a 3% correction going, oh, this is great. I'll hold this for 30 years. I mean, he fucking throws elbows. And look... As Cahotas just said on my podcast a couple days ago, this is a serious business. It's a, you know, it's a tough business. You have to be tough. It's a belt and suspenders business. So that's that. But again, my whole point was his style and Jeremy Siegel's, you know, stocks for the long run. They're only genius if the whole system holds up, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Did you see the Buffett special on HBO?
Mm-mm.
Like, oh my God, I wanted to throw up. It was such a PR piece. It was such bullshit. But the weird part about it is, like, he was married and then started banging, like, the live-in housekeeper. And, you know, they made it sound like
The wife was okay. It was fucking bizarre.
Buffett did.
Yeah. You got to watch it. It's fucking weird.
I don't think I do have to watch it.
No, but... no.
Anyways. All right, man. Well, listen, I'm going to call it a morning, if you don't mind. I don't want to waste either of our times on a Sunday morning, but let's do it again.
Let's spend 5 more minutes. To give me your opinion on this whole SEC Tesla clusterfuck that happened Thursday,
oh my
Friday.
God! Well, I wasn't even going to ask you about Tesla because I didn't want. This is not a Tesla podcast.
No. I want to know your opinion. You know my opinion.
Well, what do you fucking think my opinion is? The guy obviously appears to have committed securities fraud, and you're asking for my opinion on what? Whether the SEC will act?
Will the board act? Is the board all of a sudden going to say, "Hey, we got to play"?
The board of directors, okay. Has just been, I said this on one of my last podcasts. Well, this guy has been out mouthing off on Twitter and calling this guy a pedo and getting Montana Skeptic's boss on the phone and all this other stupid shit he's done. You know, Kimball Musk has been flipping vegan burgers at his fucking restaurant. With his cowboy hat on, thinking, oh, life is good and nothing's going on. You know, like it's like a board full of Mr. Beans. Everybody's kind of... Yeah. Looking around, maybe looking at the other person. Nobody's really doing anything. I think now, to be honest with you, the board is starting to turn on him a little bit. And especially with that piece that came out on Thursday night where
The Woe Is Me piece?
Yeah, exactly, where he did that big, huge interview. And the first iteration of the interview that was published said nobody on the board knew about what had happened. And then immediately afterwards, one of the board members contacted the New York Times and said, whoa, 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 I talked to him on August 7th about this.
So they're CYA mode, full scale.
Well, they have to be. I mean, I think if the board of directors doesn't understand that all this guy is doing is heaping liability onto them, then they're going to be in for a rude awakening. But I just wrote on Twitter yesterday, I think Musk has gone from the company's biggest asset to his biggest liability. And the fact that they can't get him under control, the fact that this fucking board of directors did not reprimand him or prevent him from using Twitter after the pedo thing, now has they're reaping what they've sown, right? They did nothing. Yep. So now they have a much bigger problem, which is this $420 go private offer tweet. And if they don't rein him in again, they're gonna have a bigger problem on top of this,
because he can't shut the fuck up. That's all you gotta do.
He can't. You're right.
Nothing.
You're right. And look, I don't know if there's mental health issues or whatever involved or drug use. You know, the guy needs some help. He needs to take a break. He needs to take a rest. Okay. I was at the bar last night talking to one of my buddies about this, who says, you know, he's running four companies. He's running SpaceX. He's running the Boring Company. He's running Tesla.
They're all frauds. Every single one.
Well, that would be a different discussion for a different day. You know, I think, isn't SpaceX profitable though?
Ow. Yeah, if you consider the account the free money they get from NASA, it might be.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't know anything about their accounting.
If you get a $500 grant from the government and don't spend it, are you profitable? Yeah, you made $500.
Well, I would take that grant. I think anybody would. I think the banks probably enjoyed taking that grant in 2008. It's the same thing, right?
That is true. I'm actually disappointed. I was hoping the stock was going to go to 250 yesterday because I really wanted to see that ass tattoo you were going to get.
Oh, I would have done it. First off, I never said it was going to be an ass tattoo. I just said it would be a tattoo. But I would have done it. Yeah. Oh, yeah. My friends.
Is it weird that I envisioned an ass tattoo?
It is.
I just creep myself out there. It's fucking bizarre.
It is kind of weird. It gives me some insight as to how you're thinking about me when we're not talking for a while. And quite frankly, it's a little disturbing. So, anyways, yeah, exactly. Look,
where do you think it goes from here? I mean, you think they get their shit together, or the stock just craters?
I don't know. I just know that I think Ross Gerber is going to come on next week. I think on Tuesday, and I'm really looking forward to talking to him about it. So that'll be the next big kind of Tesla main event podcast. I don't know what
your tolerance for bullshit is much larger than mine.
Well, I almost just find it amusing. I mean, I think
it's really.
I think that these podcasts, especially the one, you know, the one I did with him and Netflix, where we were talking about Netflix, I think they're going to serve to be interesting case studies going forward to have this stuff documented. And, you know, regardless, and I'm not saying that as a comment like, oh, I think I'm going to be vindicated and I definitely think I'm going to be right. But I think that in the future, you know, there was this really cool paper that somebody did in like 2009. It was called the Message Board Warning Signs from Enron. It was a PhD thesis or something. And they went back and they aggregated all of the things that people were saying on the Yahoo Finance message boards about
at bag holder quotes.
Yeah, about Enron. And people, well, no, I'm talking about whistleblowers too. There were people that were writing on the Yahoo message boards like, you guys have no idea what's going on the seventh floor. Fucking Ken Lay is running this company into the ground. It's a fraud. There's shit off the balance sheet. And nobody was listening. And there were, it's a fascinating read if you can go find it. They list all of the different statements. And people were basically saying, I mean, yes, there were some bag holder quotes, but people were basically saying, you know, I'm an employee. They're coming around. They're checking people's browser history to make sure that they're not on the message boards. They're worried about people speaking out, this, that, and the other thing. There were so many indications that shit was going wrong. And I think to look at that now is such an interesting postmortem. And I think that just getting this stuff down is going to be interesting by itself, regardless of what happens. If they go private or if they don't, I mean, I think the company's destined for failure regardless. Sure. But yeah, I mean, it's, I think it'll be interesting to look back on, don't you?
Yeah, no, I think so too. And, you know, look, when I was on with Ross, he's super nice guy, but he kind of reminds me of the epitome of the retail investor. Like, this is what the rest of the world thinks when they're not calling bullshit on everything like you and I do.
Well, I think what I would say is that he has done very well for his clients probably over the last 10 years by... Well, exactly. That's true. And he's, you know, his AUM is on the rise and has doubled over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I saw a tweet the other day of a billboard for his company. So they advertise and he's got a PR guy that gets him on the news networks, which is impressive to people that
I'm aware.
Right. So, you know, to see him on Fox Business News, CNBC, arguing any point, whether it's valid or not valid, in a nice suit, I think is impressive to people that don't understand the industry. And I think that the playing field is going to change drastically when we enter recession or when some shit hits the fan. And I think that if he believes that he's going to be able to invest the same way that he's been investing at a time like that, he will get smashed.
He's in for a rude awakening.
Right, right. And so... But I mean, look, you can look at it both ways. I just said this on my last podcast. People that are bearish and people that are kind of skeptics like I am, I mean, we appear to be wrong, quote unquote wrong, during the middle of a bull market. While everybody else who's just fucking throwing a dart and picking 10 stocks to invest in is tripling their money. So
I guarantee his rate of return over the last 10 years is higher than either yours or mine.
Oh, assuredly. Assuredly. I guarantee you. I guarantee you you're right. I guarantee you you're right. But, you know, like Peter Schiff said, I'm looking for the big score at the end of the day, right? I'm not looking to go out and I don't know. I don't have it in me to go out and buy shares of a company with a shit balance sheet that's trading at an insane multiple to book that doesn't produce any cash and go out there and say, well, I hope this stock quadruples. It's not my style. It's not how I invest. And if that means I'm going to underperform the market now, then that's fine. But when the shit hits the fan... And we're holding out of the money put options on the whole system or even just on, you know, some of the indices or some select companies, you know, we'll be making 30 to 50 times our money probably.
Yeah, you're looking at triple digits overnight.
So we'll see, man. That's what makes a market. Everybody's got their own style, right?
The good news is I think we've topped because I bought some Square the other day.
Oh, so, there you go. Okay.
Yeah, when it was selling off hard, I bought some, so I assume I just called the market top, so you're welcome.
I don't know anything about Square except I see it everywhere, and I would buy it just based on that. I see, like, all these new coffee shops and breweries and all this shit that are opening around here. They're all using it.
So. Everybody uses it because, you know, the Visas and the MasterCards of the world want to charge you a rate fee every month for the service.
How's that for due diligence, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
but, you know, the interesting thing with a guy like Ross, and I don't want to talk too much about him because he's not here to defend himself, but if you go back and you listen to the podcast about Netflix, when Netflix was trading at like 410 or 417 or whatever it was, and he comes on the podcast and he's talking about how it's one of his biggest positions, and then he says it's overvalued. And I'm like, well, he's like the only problem with Netflix is that it's overvalued. I'm like, yeah, well, if it's overvalued, why do you own it? Well, we bought it at $250. We bought it much lower, whatever. Like, all right, well, wouldn't that say to you maybe I should take some off, whatever? And I think he did wind up taking some off after that conversation at over 400.
Well, so he took some off when it was down $40 the other day.
Well, when you can't. When you can't put two and two together like that and you're just kind of flying blind, I don't know. I'd be interested to see how investors like that do when the tide turns. If the tide ever turns again, Adam, who the fuck knows? Yes. We could be at Dow 50,000 in a year from now.
We could be. But hey, just one other point before we wrap this up. So the most interesting thing about all this Tesla bullshit is now that there's an official SEC investigation, they can't raise capital. They're dead.
Well, that's what I've heard. I've heard that the investigation going from informal to formal is what's going to preclude them from raising capital. I don't know if that's accurate. I'd want to ask John Gavin. Maybe I have him on this show.
So it's not an official thing, but if you have $10 billion, would you invest it in a company that you have no idea what's what?
Well, of course not. Of course not. And how would you feel if you were the Saudis and you came in and made a $3 billion equity investment and then the same day this guy's going out and telling people that, oh, you're in the running to buy the whole company or to help take the company private when you probably never had that discussion with the company to begin with? You would feel like a real fucking fool, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you didn't think the guy was a huckster, I promised myself I had to use that term because it's fucking great. Yeah, if you didn't think the guy was a huckster to begin with, you know, he basically just sold your sovereign wealth fund, you know, for 80 cents on the dollar.
The only advantage that he has is the Saudis have a lot of money and they're not known to be the best investors in the world.
Yeah.
So if anybody can come in and throw cash at a problem that they shouldn't be throwing cash at, it would probably be the Saudis.
It's either the Saudis or the U.S. Department of Treasury, one of the two.
Exactly. All right, man. Listen, I want to wrap it up. I appreciate you so much taking the time on a Sunday morning to lay out all the shit about the GSEs. It was a long time coming. And let's do it again sometime soon when we get some news on either front. I'll have you back on in a couple months, and we'll talk about it again.
Yeah, or we can find a new topic to discuss. We'll see.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, well, just come on. We'll just shoot the shit, man. You know what you're talking about. You're a smart guy, so I like having your perspective.
All right, man. Enjoy your Sunday.
All right, Adam. Thanks so much, buddy. All right, that was the one, the only Adam Spittler coming on the QTR podcast today, August 19th, 2018, to lay down the Fannie and Freddie fiasco along with some added bonus content there at the end. One more time before I split, I just want to say that my podcast is brought to you by my Patreons. Very grateful to have the support of people that choose to make a small recurring donation through my Patreon. Guys like Julius Fleischer, Bill Williams, Will DiOrio, thank you guys so much for riding with me. And I hope the podcast today was informative and helped out. Got a wild week coming up next week. Really stoked to have a couple of guests that I want to talk to, one of which I think Ross is going to come back on Tuesday, and then I think I have a guy for Thursday that will remain nameless for right now. But anyways, that's going to do it, fools. Catch you next time. Peace.